Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. What happens when people take to the streets to march under the banner of science? How do you sort out the truth from the misconceptions and lies? Is science in danger, and if so, from whom? And while we're at it, what is science, and does it belong to everyone? Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation came together to answer these questions in an event called March for Science or March for Scientism, Understanding the Real Threats to Science in America. The panel discussion included Stephen Meyer, Wesley J. Smith, Jay Richards, and Marla Lewis. On a handful of episodes, we bring you highlights of the event in bite-sized segments. Today, director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute and author of Darwin's Doubt, Stephen C. Meyer, discusses what he sees as the real threats to science in America.
In fact, there are two definitions of science, two ways to think about this. There's the science as a method of acquiring data and evidence about the natural world and evaluating that evidence, interpreting that evidence. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, there's science as applied materialistic philosophy or applied naturalism, a worldview, which says that matter and energy are all that exists and that any ethical value is derived from nature itself. I did my PhD work on a method of scientific reasoning called the method of multiple competing hypotheses. And one of the things that happens when people appeal to consensus as a way of establishing what is or is not science is that those people who make such appeals actually undercut this very method of scientific evaluation. This is the first definition of science, a method of reasoning or evaluating data. There's a wonderful Italian philosopher of science named Marcello Pera, who argues in his book, The Discourses of Science, that science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret the evidence, the relevant evidence in a given field. If you have people subverting that process of argumentation by appeals to consensus, which end up using stigmatizing rhetoric like deniers, I love that one, who really is a science denier, only people who disagree with us, then the people who make such appeals are actually undercutting the method of science, or one of the key methods of science, which involves this comparative hypothesis testing, which requires, as a part of that method, the ability to argue freely about how to interpret evidence. And we have an awful lot of that going on in a number of these different hot-button scientific issues that are at the forefront of the March for Science. And when that happens, what invariably ensues when you have these appeals to consensus or settled science or stigmatizing anyone who disagrees as a science denier, what happens then is you enshrine a particular scientific point of view or maybe an ethical extension of that point of view as a kind of ideology. And one of the ideological factions in this March for Science that's coming up is a group of people that I like to call Darwin's public defenders. And this is my little piece in this panel and discussion. The public defenders are people like Bill Nye, the science guy, Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, formerly Eugenie Scott, who was the head of the National Center for Science Education. And these folks are promoting Darwinian evolution not only as settled science, but in the case of Dawkins and Krauss especially, as the basis for a fully materialistic ideology, which they in fact call the new atheism. They argue that science properly understood supports an atheistic worldview. And the science they have in mind is the theory of Darwinian evolution. And Dawkins' argument is very interesting on this. He says that prior to Darwin, the strongest argument for God's existence was the evidence of design in nature. But since the advent of Darwinian theory, we now know that there isn't really design in nature, only the appearance of design. Why is the appearance of design that we see in biological systems, whether it's the complex structure of the eye or the different wiring and chambers of the heart or the coiled nautilus or the digital code in DNA, why are these appearances of design not really design? Well, according to both classical Darwinism and modern neo-Darwinism, these appearances are merely illusions because there's an unguided, undirected mechanism, namely natural selection acting on random variations and mutations that can produce that appearance of design without being guided or directed in any way. So the foundation of the new atheism is neo-Darwinism. The foundation of neo-Darwinism is the claim that natural selection and random mutation have unlimited creative power, including the power to produce intricate integrated systems that give the appearance of having been designed, but were not in fact designed because they were produced by this undirected process. Now, I wrote a book a couple years ago called Darwin's Doubt. And part of the title was to contrast Darwin's own self-reflective and rhetorical modesty with the rhetorical excess of his current public defenders. But another purpose of the book was to highlight the huge disparity that presently exists between the presentation of the status of Darwinian theory, of contemporary Darwinian theory, in the media, in policy statements by groups like the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in the statements that are made by people like Bill Nye, the science guy who's written a book recently called Undeniable, which is what he thinks the evidence for neo-Darwinism is, and Richard Dawkins, who says that if you doubt neo-Darwinism, you're either stupid, ignorant, or insane, or then he says, or possibly wicked, but he'd prefer not to consider that. I always thought that was rather sporting of him not to consider that. But you see this huge rhetorical excess in support of an alleged consensus in support further of neo-Darwinian theory. And yet, when you get into the technical literature in biology, you find that leading biologists, including leading evolutionary biologists, now openly doubt the creative power of the central mechanism of neo-Darwinian theory, which is the mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations. This came home to me very poignantly several years ago. I was testifying before the Texas State Board of Education. They had an innocuous policy proposal that they were putting forward in which they were suggesting that teachers be allowed to inform students about the strengths and weaknesses of competing scientific hypotheses. The Darwin-only science education lobby turned out in force to say the Texas State Board could not apply that to their theory, to the theory of neo-Darwinian evolution, because in the words of Eugenie Scott, evolution, quote, has no weaknesses. Now, I was there to testify, and part of my testimony put into evidence 100 peer-reviewed scientific papers that were raising questions about the central mechanism of neo-Darwinism, again, natural selection acting on random mutations. Many scientists now say that that mechanism explains the survival, but not the arrival of the fittest. It explains the small-scale variations, but it does not explain the major morphological innovations, the major innovations in form that we see arising episodically in the history of life as documented by the fossil record. Now, in November, I attended, along with a number of other scientists in our larger network, the meeting of the Royal Society of London. It's the oldest and most august scientific body in the world. They, for the first time, have put on the table in their November meeting the status of neo-Darwinism as a point of scientific discussion. Many of the scientists there were part of a group that has been called the Altenburg 16 or the Third Way or the proponents of an extended synthesis. These are scientists who have utterly now rejected neo-Darwinism as an adequate theory of evolution and are looking for new evolutionary mechanisms to either supplement or replace the neo-Darwinian mechanism of natural selection and random mutation, because they also believe that that mechanism lacks the creative power to generate fundamental innovation in the history of life. One of the first speakers at this conference, Gerd Müller, leading Austrian evolutionary biologist, started by outlining the explanatory deficits of this textbook orthodoxy, the theory that we all learn in high school and college biology textbooks. And the deficits that he outlined were as follows. Its inability to explain biological or phenotypic complexity, the inability to explain morphological novelty, the problem of the abrupt appearance of major innovations in the history of life. These are major problems with the theory that are well documented in the peer-reviewed literature, that were discussed openly at a major scientific conference this last summer, and yet you will not hear a word of that breathed in the March for Science. There will be many factions in this march who will be advocating for textbook orthodoxy and not acknowledging that these scientific problems even exist. I'd like to just highlight a little bit from my perspective why these problems are so acute and so formidable. The big discovery in modern biology comes in the 1950s with the molecular biological revolution. Watson and Crick elucidate the structure of DNA in 1953. 4 years later, Francis Crick puts forward a phenomenally insightful hypothesis called the sequence hypothesis, in which he notes that the DNA molecule with its twisting helix shape encodes along its spine information in a digital or alphabetic form. That the chemical subunits called bases that run along the spine of the DNA, literally, he proposed, function as digital characters or alphabetic characters in a section of meaningful information, meaningful either text or software. The DNA is storing information in a digital typographic or alphabetic form, information that, as it turns out, is crucial to the construction of the proteins and protein machines that are necessary for all forms of life to exist. Now, this has raised an incredible set of questions for evolutionary theory. In particular, where did that information come from? Here's the situation. If you want to give your computer a new function, we all know you have to provide code. The same thing turns out to be true in the history of life. Whenever we see a large jump in the complexity of living organisms, innovations occurring in the fossil record, those morphological innovations, innovations in form, would have required informational infusions, inputs of information to produce that new form. Just as the computer, new function requires new information, in biology the same is true. New form and function requires new information. So there's a huge question of where that information comes from. And this has been the problem that increasingly evolutionary biologists and chemical evolutionary theorists who are concerned about the origin of the first life have had to address. And here's the problem. If you have a basic awareness of computer programming, ask yourself the question. If you have a section of digital code, digital information, and you start randomly changing the bits, the digital characters, are you more likely to degrade that information or generate a new operating system or a computer program? Programmers, when I ask the question rhetorically, always laugh. Inevitably, random changes in a sequence of functional information are going to degrade that information and degrade it to non-functionality long before you would ever get to a new functional program or operating system. It turns out that in all probability, the same is true in living systems. And so the neo-Darwinian mechanism, which relies precisely on random changes called mutations in the arrangement of these digital or chemical characters, is subject to that same problem of informational degradation. The mechanism which is proposed as a means of generating new form actually degrades information rather than generating it, and yet you need new information to generate new form. So that, among many other problems, lies at the heart of this increasing crisis in the orthodox theory. Leading biologists at the Royal Society meeting have been quoted in other contexts as saying, neo-Darwinism has no theory of the generative, and that skepticism about neo-Darwinism is now actually passé, so early 90s, one leading biologist said. Now, this message is not getting through to the general public, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book Darwin's Doubt. The problem that Darwin was concerned about was the origin of the major animal groups in an event called the Cambrian Explosion. But as I show in my book, that problem is actually only the leading edge of a much deeper problem, which is not just the origin of new forms in the fossil record, it's the origin of the information necessary to build those forms. And so the skepticism about the theory continues to grow in scientific circles, and yet at the same time you have this strange disconnect where the ideological promulgation of the orthodox theory goes on unabated with ever louder denunciations for anyone who raises questions about it in public, as again, science deniers or people who are anti-science or pseudoscience. You get all the same epithets in all the different debates. So my concern today is to expose some of the scientific problems with the theory and return to a situation in science where we can have an open evaluation of competing hypotheses without stigmatizing alternative views as against the scientific method. In fact, it's people who do that, who stigmatize alternative perspectives and alternative theories or hypotheses, who are acting in a profoundly anti-scientific way insofar as they are shutting down the very discourse of science which is necessary for the evaluation of scientific hypotheses, which is how science advances. Thank you very much.
That was Stephen Meyer on a panel event co-hosted by Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation, discussing the real threats to science in America. For more on these topics, check out our written coverage of the March for Science at The Stream. You'll find it at stream.org/tag/ScienceWeek2017. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.